Psalm 90, if you would turn there with me this morning, that will be our text and the focus of our attention. One of my favorite psalms, a hard one. It's a psalm that I think hurts, but it hurts that in a way that it ultimately heals. I spent a summer, prior to my wife and I getting married, while I was in university, I spent a summer working at a church. Just 2 or 3 months there, and the church actually housed me across the street. They had an old church building that they used to meet in, that they no longer used. And so they housed me there for the summer, and that church building across the street actually sat on a cemetery. And I often had time in the evenings after dinner and such, and I would go out and walk through that cemetery. I frequently took walks through it, and at first it was a little bit weird. Actually living on that property just felt weird. It would get dark at night, and even though you're a grown man, something just feels a little bit weird about that scenario. But I actually started taking walks through the cemetery, even though you felt a bit uncomfortable, you know you're surrounded by death. After you think about it, you're like, it's just ground, it's just earth, it's just stones, and I got used to it. But some of those graves, I ended up looking at them, some of them were over 100 years old. And you look at enough tombstones, you look at those, does it ever just shock you that the entirety of a person's life, the whole thing, ends up being summed up actually by a little tiny dash? I mean, I look at that, and you look at those, and it's just shocking. It's uncomfortable. There's something extremely bothersome about that that I don't think most of us want to grapple with, and yet we need to, and we must. And actually, this psalm is going to make us do that in an uncomfortable way, but actually in a way that's really healthy. You live in a broken world, as we read in Genesis chapter 3, and mortal man cannot find meaning apart from an eternal God. Let's look at Psalm 90 together. I'll read this psalm, the whole thing, before we dive into it. This is a psalm of Moses. The subtitle there at the beginning says, "The Prayer of Moses, the Man of God." And we read, Moses writes, "Lord, you have been our dwelling place in all generations." That's a huge statement if you think about Moses' life and where he actually lived, where he spent large portions of his life living. "Lord, you have been our dwelling place in all generations before the mountains were brought forth, or ever you had formed the earth and the world. From everlasting to everlasting, you are God. You return man to the dust and say, 'Return, O children of man.' For 1,000 years in your sight are but as yesterday when it is past, or as a watch in the night. You sweep them away as with a flood. They are like a dream, like grass that is renewed in the morning. In the morning it flourishes and is renewed, and in the evening it fades and withers. For we are brought to an end by your anger. By your wrath we are dismayed. You have set our iniquities before you, our secret sins in the light of your presence, for all our days pass away under your wrath. We bring our years to an end like a sigh. The years of our life are 70, or even by reason of strength, 80. Yet their span is but toil and trouble. They are soon gone and we fly away. Who considers the power of your anger and your wrath according to the fear of you? So teach us to number our days, that we may get a heart of wisdom. Return, O Lord, how long? Have pity on your servants. Satisfy us in the morning with your steadfast love, that we may rejoice and be glad all our days. Make us glad for as many days as you have afflicted us, and for as many years as we have seen evil. Let your work be shown to your servants and your glorious power to their children. Let the favor of the Lord our God be upon us, and establish the work of our hands upon us." Yes, establish the work of our hands. Based on the subtitle that we just briefly looked at, which reads, "A Prayer of Moses, the Man of God," this is probably the oldest psalm in the Psalter. Moses probably wrote it during the 40-year wilderness wandering. You remember that story. It's not a pretty story. It's not a fun story. It's just problem after problem, sin after sin, disaster after disaster in the wilderness. Over 1 million Israelites left Egypt bound for the Promised Land. They're all excited. And 1 million is probably a very conservative estimate, actually. And yet, as all these people are headed towards Canaan, how many of them actually make it there? Two. None of the adults made it there except for two. Moses didn't even make it there. You remember that Moses became furious and angry before the people and basically disgraced God before them. He doesn't even make it into the promised land. Why? Because these people have all sinfully rebelled against God, and God consequently condemned them to 40 years of wandering and death in the wilderness. These people had no dwelling place. They didn't have homes of brick and mortar. They didn't even stay put. They roamed throughout the wilderness for 40 years. Conservatively estimating, something like 72 people died every day in the wilderness for 38 plus years. That's a lot of graves scattered throughout the wilderness. And something that Moses probably would have been constantly confronted with as the leader of all these people. Though we don't know exactly when Moses wrote this, perhaps he wrote it at the end of his life. He's witnessed a whole generation of people. He's witnessed a million people die in the wilderness. And perhaps another generation is about to enter the promised land. We're going to look at three quickly forgotten facts from this text. And the first one is that God is eternal. The middle of this psalm is actually going to focus for a long time on God's wrath and God's anger and the death that's coming your way. But you'll notice that that's not how it starts, and that's not how it ends. It actually starts quite positive and it ends quite positive. God is eternal. He has no beginning. He has no end. He is from everlasting to everlasting. And in the first couple of verses, his eternality is described in a couple ways. He is the eternal Lord. Verse 1 begins with the title Lord. That title means master or sovereign. Moses is recognizing God, you are the one and only master and Lord. Eternally, God is in charge. He is Lord. He's also our eternal dwelling place. Look at verse 1 again. Moses writes, Lord, you have been our dwelling place in all generations. From generation to generation, eternally, God is a dwelling place for his people. He's a refuge. He's a home. Moses and the people of Israel had no dwelling place in the wilderness. They're in tents. They're just moving from here to there. Moses would have never come to dwell in Canaan. And no doubt as they set out, that's what Moses was looking forward to. I want to go and I want to dwell in Canaan. I want to go dwell and make the promised land my dwelling place. But Moses ends up realizing that he had something far superior. God says, Moses, you're never going there. Due to your sin, you will never reach the shores of Canaan. You're not entering. And yet Moses writes, God, I've found something better than Canaan. I found that you are my dwelling place. You are our dwelling place. God was his refuge. Moses came to learn that God is better than Canaan. God is an eternal place of rest where God's people can put up their feet and they can relax and they can find meaning and significance in life amidst all the troubles and storms that come. He is our eternal dwelling place. And he's also described in verse 2 as the eternal creator. Look at verse 2. Before the mountains were brought forth, or ever you had formed the earth and the world, from everlasting to everlasting, you are God. Long before anything was created, God was. He existed. You look at the mountains. I mean, most of us are wishing that we were on our trips to the mountains right now and just going anywhere and everywhere but here. We've been here so long. God, I just want to go somewhere, anywhere. Don't the mountains sound nice? And you make that trip to the Canadian Rockies, and you're driving and you're approaching, and just these massive boulders protruding out of the ground. And they just look like they've been there forever, that they're unmovable and they're unshakable. And we're reminded here that before the mountains ever were, there was God. And the language is interesting here in verse 2. Verse 2 says that God brought forth or birthed the planet. God produced the planet. Before the earth was, God was. And as verse 2 says, from everlasting to everlasting, you are God. And with almost every line of the psalm that's going to come next, God's eternality is being contrasted with you and your mortality. As I was pulling into a parking lot the other day, I think I was pulling into Home Depot or something like that, I noticed a truck next to me, and it had on the door panel there a sign for the business that it represented. But what caught my eye was actually the little tagline underneath the company's name and logo. The door panel read something like this: serving the Edmonton region for over 85 years. Businesses like that, right? If you're a new business, you're not highlighting how long you've been around. But if you've been around for 85 years, we've been doing this. We've been doing it well for a long time. You can trust us. We have this awesome track record, 85 years in the Edmonton area. And I think that's actually what's going on in verses 1 and 2. God's saying, serving my people, being a refuge for my people, from everlasting to everlasting, no matter which direction you look, I've been a dwelling place for my people throughout every generation. Through high points, through low points, throughout all time. God has successfully been a dwelling place for his children for every generation. Now we want to catch the high point of these first couple of verses because it's about to take a dark turn. But we want to see the darkness in the presence of the light, so to speak. God is eternal. He is your eternal dwelling place, which takes on even greater significance as we consider a second quickly forgotten fact, namely that God will return you to the dust. Look at verse 3. Verse 3 says, "You return man to the dust and say, 'Return, O children of man.'" And the Hebrew language there is actually quite strong, this whole dust idea. God is saying that he pulverizes man. Just obliterates him to complete, utter nothingness. In Genesis 3:19, which we read in our scripture reading, God said to Adam, "By the sweat of your face you shall eat bread, till you return to the ground. For out of it you are taken, for you are dust, and to dust you shall return." And what's interesting in verse 3, God is saying something. He's saying, "I've decreed something for you." God is saying, "Return, O children of man," or "Return," quite literally, "O sons of Adam. Return to the ground. God has decreed your death. You are going to die." And Moses, throughout all these years of the wilderness, it's just been an everyday perpetual reminder. Just as God spoke the universe into existence in Genesis 1, you remember that. As God talks about creating the universe, he doesn't say, "Well, you know, I took a week and I fashioned the fish. And I made them this way and I made them that way. It took me a week and I got it done." No, as you read Genesis chapter 1, it says God spoke and it was. God's just speaking everything into existence. You look at verse 3 of Psalm 90, what is God doing? He's not speaking anything into existence. He's speaking you out of it with a word. And he's saying, these are God's words, "Return, O children of man," and boom, man enters the dust. He's pulverized. Just as God spoke the universe into existence in Genesis 1, God will speak you out of it. Wow. And Moses, he's not just going to mention that. He's going to, let's talk about this in detail, line by line. And so what does he have to say? Well, "You will not always be. God will always be." Look at verse 4. "For 1,000 years in your sight are but as yesterday when it is past, or as a watch in the night." We tend to view God from our vantage point, right? We think of seconds and minutes and hours and years and decades. And God's asking us here, no, let's look at you through my vantage point. Let's look at it the other way around. It does the opposite. Your life is but a blip on God's timeline. Verse 4 leaves you feeling very, very, very small in comparison to God. Talks about a watch in the night, 1,000 years. A watch in the night was 3-4 hours. There were multiple watches of the night. How much do you remember from last night? Let's say between 2 in the morning and 6 in the morning. What do you remember about that? For me, nothing. And God is saying that even 1,000 years is just a blip. Just like a watch in the night. Your whole life is small, it's short, you will not always be, but God will always be. Verse 4 leaves you feeling small. Verse 5 reminds you that you are actually powerless against death. Look at verse 5. It says, you sweep them away as with a flood. They are like a dream, like grass that is renewed in the morning. Man's life is swept away like a great flood, and man ends up sleeping. That's the idea of the dream language there. He dies. God is going to sweep you away, and there's nothing you can do about it. You don't have the power to stay put. You don't have the power to just hold on and stay here a little bit longer. Not even for a moment. I think, man, how God must be laughing right now as our entire world just tries to stay put. We can do this and we can do that and we can prevent this and we can prevent that and we can all just stay put here a little bit longer. Not according to verse 5. You are powerless to stay put. One of the trees near our house, actually it may be many of the trees near our house, have been shedding these, I don't even know what they are. They're just these little leafy, flaky things. They're super light. They're almost transparent. I'm not sure if they're coming off our spruce trees or another tree, but I've got hundreds of these scattered all over around our house. These little sheddings off the tree. Well, as you know, we've got a lot of rain recently, and I was walking around my house after one of those big rains, and I walked right by one of the downspouts. Actually, both my downspouts coming off my house, I noticed that shot out right at the end of those downspouts were just these piles of these little leafy flakes. I have no clue what they are, but they're just piled up at the end of this downspout. Well, what happened? They didn't stay put on the tree. The wind took them to wherever in my yard or on my roof, and then the rain came, washed it down the shingles, into the gutter, down the downspout, and out into the grass. Those little flakes were absolutely powerless to stay put. And the water came and just washed them away. And God is saying, your life is like that. You're powerless to stay put. You'll be swept away. God is saying, and he's even saying now, return, O son of Adam, to the dust. He will sweep you away in a moment. In verse 6, you will quickly flourish and fade. Look at verses 5 and 6. You sweep them away as with a flood. They are like a dream. Like grass that is renewed in the morning. In the morning it flourishes and is renewed. In the evening it fades and withers. These verses describe the human life cycle, and they compare it to grass. Probably not so much our grass, maybe like what we'd have here in Alberta, but in Palestine, in that area and such, the grass would be much different. Here's your lifestyle, verses 5 and 6. Basically, it's brief, and it's going to flourish, and then it's going to fade. Man reaches his zenith quickly, and it's downhill from there. Happy Father's Day. Like, it's really great. Various studies indicate that men and women tend to peak physically in their late 20s, early 30s. Actually, like, you may peak at that age and you may be able to kind of maintain it for 20 years or something like that. But you peak at that age and then it's the decline happens. It's real. And we laugh, but like, we all know it's life. After this time, after you peak, muscle mass, strength, and flexibility begin to decline. And unfortunately, I think for us men, our maturity never seems to peak. Just never gets there. Even though our bodies peak and decline, we're just trying to grow up the whole time, all the way along. When I read this verse and I think about the grass, I think of actually a very similar comparison. Maybe you could think of your life like a dandelion. I know, it's flattering. Over the last couple of weeks, when I've looked out in my yard, I have seen thousands of dandelions. It's been a little embarrassing. But just dandelions everywhere. In fact, I've looked out at times and I've seen more yellow than green. Like, I gotta get this under control. This is embarrassing. And every year I think, one of these years I'm gonna get one of these pull behind sprayer things for my lawn tractor, and I'm just gonna nuke my whole lawn every year and I'm not gonna have a single dandelion. I haven't done that yet. But as I think about that, this thought of hope comes into my mind. You know what, Nate? It's going to be fine. Really, it's going to be fine. Your yard's going to look awful. Like, it's going to look so bad for 2 weeks, 3 weeks, 4 weeks, maybe 6 weeks. But those little yellow dandelions, they're going to be bright yellow, and then it's going to get really bad. Like, they're going to turn white and gray and flaky, and they're going to look nasty. The wind's going to blow those dandelions. I mean, it's just going to be a mess. But then it's going to be over. And in a few weeks, you'll drive by my lawn, and if you don't look closely, you'll go, wow, Nate's lawn's really green. Nate's lawn looks really nice. They just got to wait it out. The dandelions eventually, the leaves are broad. Like, don't look closely. But from afar away, it's going to look green and beautiful. And God's saying, like, that's your life. It's like grass. It's like a dandelion that it flowers. And then it turns gray and blows away. It's gone. You have no power to stay put, and you will flourish and you will fade. Your life is like that. And you will live and you will die under God's wrath. That's the theme that dominates verses 7 to 11. It's quite simple, really. You will die due to God's wrath. Look at verse 7. It says, "We are brought to an end by your anger. By your wrath, we are dismayed." God's anger is an instrument that is the instrument that brings us to our end. And I would remind you, even as we read that, that that's never how God intended it to be. Even Genesis chapter 3 that we read about, what trees were in the garden? There were two big, well-known trees in the Garden of Eden. What were they? Well, we think about the one really often, the tree of knowledge and good and evil, because that's the one that they were told not to eat of. But there was another tree. The tree of what? The tree of life. And in fact, at the end of Genesis chapter 3, God banishes Adam and Eve from that tree so that they won't continue to eat it. And presumably live on and on and on and on and on in their sin. From the very beginning, God intended us to have life. When God created Adam and Eve, He placed them in the garden with the tree of life. What happened? Well, as we read about, Adam reached out his hand. He took the fruit. He ate it and plunged the entire human race into sin. And now man lives under the curse. And now God's wrath and anger is basically infused into all of creation. Romans 6:23 is clear. The wages of sin is death. And with that in mind, I want you to look at verse 8. God says, or Moses writes, "You have set our iniquities before you, our secret sins in the light of your presence." All your sins are before God's face, even your secret ones. Think for a moment about those secret sins. Would your secret sins make anybody here on earth angry? Maybe your spouse, maybe a close friend, maybe an employer. If someone knew about your secret sins, someone might be very hurt and quite livid. Here and now, on the human level. And yet God knows about every single one of them. And He knows about every sin you've ever committed. God is angry over that sin. It causes His wrath to burn. And what is God saying? God keeps saying, "Return, return, return, return to the dust, O son of Adam." You will die due to God's wrath, and God's wrath is due to your sin. You will die due to God's wrath, and you will live under it. You will live under God's wrath. Verse 9 begins, "For all our days pass away under your wrath." All of them. We are living under the curse. The years of your life will be difficult, and they will be few. Verse 9, your life will end like a long groan. Verse 9 says, "We bring our years to an end like a sigh." You should probably plan for the final years of your life, and whether those final years maybe are summarized by a few years or actually an extended period of time, multiple years, the final years of your life, you can expect those to be like one giant groan of pain. And you don't know when that time period is going to start. My wife and I were in the ER multiple times this last week, and at one point on one of our visits, we were in an examination room that was divided by just a big curtain, just a big cloth curtain. So we're sitting on one side and there's somebody else on the other side. Well, you know how it is when you're in a room like that. Like, you're kind of listening to what's being said in the room next door. Well, there was a lady in the just on the opposite side of that curtain than us, had no idea how old she was or anything like that until she started to talk. The nurse came in, and they're just talking about her situation. And basically, we found out, listening to her, I think she was 91 years old. Somewhere in there, she gave her weight. She was under 120 pounds. And she's like, she's made it to 91. She just keeps living. And she's telling the nurse about all of her medications, all of her heart problems, her diverticulitis. I mean, the list is going on and on and on. And at one point, she mentions to the nurse, well, I was talking about this to my family doctor, and I told him when I was 91, and I was telling him about all my problems and all my blah, 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 blah. And he said something like this to me. He said, well, where are all your friends? And basically, the point was that all of her friends had passed, they had died, and she was the one who had made it, as if those were words of comfort. I've watched all my friends die, and I'm the one that's made it to 91. God is saying, like, as you get older, the groaning is just going to start. And it's going to go on until you die. Life will end like a long groan, and your life will be limited, as a general rule of thumb, to 70 or 80 years. Look at verse 10. The years of our life are 70, or even by reason of strength, 80. Yet their span is but toil and trouble. They are soon gone, and we fly away. Your life has an expiration date on it. And for some people, that's relatively short. For some people, it's a bit longer. But as a general rule, you've got 70 years. And if you get a nice pair of jeans, you might end up with 80. But don't count on it. 70 sounds pretty young, doesn't it? I mean, the older and older you get, 70 sounds younger and younger and younger. And for some of you guys, you're looking back on 70 going, that was young. Like, 70 just doesn't sound that old. And some of you are already past that. In some ways, you're living on borrowed time. And I think we look at a number like that and we place ourselves, we look at the 70 years and we place ourselves where we're at in that journey. Well, I'm 31. I've got how many years left? You may look at your life and go, I'm 45. I'm already past the halfway point. Or I'm 55, or I'm 60, and I'm already 70. And it's just this sobering reminder to us that our lives will not go on forever on this earth. Almost everything in your fridge has an expiration date. You take your milk, for example. You buy that from the store. You maybe have 2 weeks, something like that. I don't know. You've got to drink it or it's going to go bad. The shelf life just isn't that long. There's an expiration date on your body. It's 70 years. Maybe 80 if you're stored properly at the right temperature. You might make it to 80. And God just says in verse 10, those years, those 70 to 80 years, your life will be actually difficult. Look at verse 10. The years of our life are 70, or even by reason of strength, 80. Yet their span, from beginning to end, is but toil and trouble. They are soon gone, and we fly away. Toil and trouble, what a pair that is. That's the language of Genesis 3, is it not? Toil, trouble, sweat, tears, sorrow, pain. And we call this life in a fallen world. All of creation groans because this was never meant to be. And then as this section on God's wrath and death is wrapped up in verse 11, God gives us this point. You cannot begin to grasp God's wrath. Look at verse 11. Who considers or understands the power of your anger and your wrath according to the fear of you? Another translation asks, who understands the power of your anger? Your wrath matches the fear that is due you. You have no idea. I have no idea. I can't even hardly begin to grasp how angry God is over sin. You can't begin to grasp God's wrath. In fact, most of us don't even give it a second thought. We don't even try. We don't even want to. Most of humanity just ignores it. God is angry and he's saying, return, 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 return. He's saying that to you and he's saying it to all of humanity. Return, O son of Adam, to the dust from which you came. God's going to return you to the dust. But for as much space that death and morbidity occupy in this psalm, as I mentioned, it's neither the theme nor the focus. even though so much time and attention is given to it. Rather, at the beginning and end of this text, your mortality is framed by God's eternality. So we move to a third quickly forgotten fact, and that God is the secret to life. In terms of commentators on the Psalms, one of my favorites is a man by the name of Derek Kidner. He's just got a short commentary on the Psalms, but it's really good. And here's what he says about this Psalm. He says, God is seen here as our God, whose eternity is the answer, not simply the antithesis to our homelessness and our brevity of life. Did you catch that? God's not just contrasting your mortality with his eternality. He's saying, don't you see that my eternality is the answer to your mortality? And in such a way that the last few verses of this psalm actually become a prayer. Like, God, if all of this is true, help us to live this way. Help us to rest in you as our dwelling place. Help us to get it. So what can God help you to do? God can help you actually to live an intentional life. Look at verse 12. Moses now asks, after considering all this, he says, God, teach us to number our days, that we may get a heart of wisdom. This verse is a prayer that God would teach us and help us to learn that our days are numbered and short. You do that with your money, right? You realize that you have bills to pay and that there's only so much money. And so you look at all that you have and you allot it accordingly, hopefully. You budget your money. You say, this is my salary for a year. Here's my mortgage. Here's my utilities. Here's what groceries are going to cost. And so I take this lump sum and I start putting it here and there and there and there. And I'm allotting it where it should go so that I make that money count. And so that it lasts and it's so that it's enough. And Moses is saying, God, would you help us to see our time like that? God, would you help me to see my life like that? That there is a limited amount of this and I need to put it in all the right places and use it the right way. The egg timer, so to speak, of life is always running out. And so we pray, God, make us aware of this so that we would live with great wisdom and skill. Skill in our relationships, how we relate to the people all around us, skill in our priorities, skill in our time management, skill in our eternal investments and where we put things, not just financially, but everything. I haven't played much golf in recent years. I used to enjoy playing it quite a bit, and I would get out from time to time. I've never been really ever been good, but I've always thought it's just been nice to be in the outdoors for several hours with friends. Well, you know how golf goes, right? You step up to the tee box, you've got your big bad driver that you paid way more for than you ever should have, and it's going to help your golf game be awesome. And you step up to that tee box with that big awesome driver, and you take a few practice swings, and it feels so nice. You're like, that's the swing. I'm going to crush this ball. And there you are. You've got that perfect swing. And so you step up to the ball, you've taken a couple of practice swings, now you're going to crank that thing straight up the fairway. It's just going to drop right in the middle of the fairway in the nice short grass, and you're going to have a nice second shot teed up for you on that grass. You step up to that ball, and you crush it. I mean, you just crush it. It's going so straight, and then it just whoosh, rips to the right, and you have crushed that thing 250 yards in the wrong direction. And at that moment, standing on the tee box, you look down at your friends by the carts and you say, how many mulligans did we say we're going to play with? Did we say, was it one? Was it two? I want a redo. Well, in life, there are no mulligans. You only get one crack at it. And Moses, after realizing just the terrible reality of the curse and death, he's so sobered by that. He's witnessed it in the wilderness for decades. And sobered by that, he says, God, would you teach us to number our days that we may get a heart of wisdom? God can help you live an intentional life, and God can help you live a satisfied life. Look at verses 13 to 15. Return, O Lord, how long? Have pity on your servant. Satisfy us in the morning with your steadfast love, that we may rejoice and be glad all our days. Make us glad for as many days as you have afflicted us, and for as many years as we have seen evil. Verse 13 begins, return, O Lord. That's not a prayer that Jesus would come back. It's a prayer that God would turn from his anger. God keeps saying to man, return, return, return to the dust. And now Moses is saying, God, would you return? Would you return from your wrath and your anger upon us and have mercy and compassion? Verse 4, I find quite interesting. Verse 14 mentions satisfaction, rejoicing, and gladness. Interesting words in the context of this psalm. Is it possible to know such things in a world that's under God's wrath? Is it possible to know satisfaction and joy and gladness when this nasty death and all of this curse is the world in which we live? Apparently it is. Based on verse 14, question for you, what is the secret to such a life? Based on verse 14, what is the secret to a satisfied life, a joyous life, a glad life? Well, Moses seems like he's discovered that. Based on verse 14, the secret to a satisfied life is God and his steadfast love. He is the secret to life, which is why Moses writes, "You have been our dwelling place." We're living in this world of the curse. Everyone's dying and dropping dead and falling person after person after person in the wilderness. And yet you are the one to whom we run and we dwell in. And we find satisfaction and joy and peace and gladness. God can help you live a satisfied life, and God can help you live a successful life. Verses 16 and 17, let your work be shown to your servants and your glorious power to their children. Let the favor of the Lord our God be upon us and establish the work of our hands upon us. Yes, establish the work of our hands. Verse 17 is a request for God's favor. God, we're living in a world of your wrath due to our sin. And in this broken place, would you give us your favor? Apparently, God does that sort of thing. It's a request that God would give success for our labors, that he would establish what we're doing. And I don't think it's just establish it here and now. God, establish it for eternity. In other words, God can help you live a life of lasting significance. You're ever being summoned to the ground. And while all that's going on, you can live in a way that surpasses your mortal life. You've got 70 or 80 years, but what you do now could count for all the years to come. And God can help you live in a way that counts. God is the secret to life. You want to ask him for success for your labors and joy for your sorrows and look to him for meaning and satisfaction. And I think one of the huge takeaways from this text is that you need to stop trying to focus on eliminating the curse. You need to stop trying to focus on eliminating everything that we read about in the middle of this psalm. Don't you get it? You can't. You need to stop focusing on eliminating the curse and start focusing on the eternal one. We spend all of our lives trying to ease our pain, trying to make our lives go on longer and longer, trying to be beautiful and attractive and keep the decline at bay. And God said, you can't do that. It's going to happen. Focus on me. Focus on dwelling in my presence. I am your dwelling place throughout every generation. In your walk with him, your focus on him, your focus on what matters to him. That's a meaningful life. That's a life that counts. And just quickly, as we wrap up a psalm so much on God's wrath, it talks about in verse 8 that our iniquities are before you. Our secret sins are in the light of your presence. Yeah, that's true. But what is before the eyes of God the Father right now? And maybe I should rephrase that. Who is before the eyes of God the Father right now? We read verse 8 and it's just this gloomy, our sins are before God the Father. And all of my secret sins, all of my iniquities. And yet we know that who is before God the Father now? Jesus. With pierced hands, with pierced sides, with a wounded head. And he's crying out, I paid for all of those sins. What an encouragement that is, that because of the work of Christ, you can live in the favor of God. Your life can be meaningful. And if you don't know God as your Savior and you're just feeling all the effects of the curse, that God is the answer. He is a dwelling place. And you can cry out to Jesus and say, forgive me of my sins. I believe that what Christ did on the cross for me is enough to satisfy all this wrath and to give me eternal life. You can ask God to save you from your sins today and grant you that, and He will. I hope you're challenged and encouraged by this text, and even on Father's Day, especially I think for dads, this is for all of us, but what are you doing? Is your focus in all the wrong places? Are you living with eternity in view with God as your dwelling place? Would you bow with me as we wrap up here today?